As Shelley said, we've known each other for a long time. Just to put some actual numbers on it, like for a long time is probably like 30 years or 25 years or something, I think. And I have Shelley and her husband Richard, who some of you may have met, to thank for having. So just to give you an idea of how long ago, it was at Shelley's house that I was first introduced to Cherry Garcia ice cream, which I've eaten too much of over the years. I wasn't entirely sure what to talk about today. It's obviously tempting to talk about the things that I'm most excited about in my lab, and which I'll say a few things about. But I also, based in part on presentations over the last week or two while I've been here, I pulled out a bunch of bits and pieces of things that are older, some much older, although not as old as my introduction to Cherry Garcia ice cream, that I think are relevant to issues that bring us all together in thinking about what tools we need to be able to build a field of evolutionary cell biology. And I'll try to touch on that and maybe suggest some areas for possible discussion. I'd like to try to, so this talk is in part a follow-on from Julius Lukacs' talk last week, which some of you heard about the weird and wonderful diversity in trypanosomes. I will be talking today about another group of microbial eukaryotes, also parasites, although I won't be talking much about the parasitism. The fact it's probably non-coincidental that both Julius's lab and mine work on parasites. There are reasons why we're interested in that from the disease perspective. I won't be saying much about disease today, but I'd really like to think more about what we as cell biologists can learn from microbial eukaryotes, and I'll suggest some insights that computational and statistical methods can provide for evolutionary cell biology, and maybe raise some questions that we might be thinking about a little bit later on. By way of introduction, let me provide a reminder that cell biologists have learned a great deal from microbial eukaryotes. Traditionally, cell biology didn't start out that way. It has focused more on animals and fungi, and animals and plants to some extent on fungi. But these pictures, I know Randy Scheckman was here a couple of weeks ago, and these are pictures from Randy's work first bringing genetic tools to bear on the cell biology of yeast. When I was a graduate student, yeast wasn't really thought to have much in the way of cell biology. You know, it's sort of just an amorphous bag. But in fact, engineering mutants dramatically changed the architecture in ways that we now understand. But it's always interesting and entertaining to go back and read some of those original papers, what we now know as the Golgi apparatus of yeast. They'd actually named the Berkeley body because they didn't know what it was, and yeast wasn't supposed to have a Golgi apparatus. The history of microbial eukaryotes and cell biology goes a bit further back. It's a picture of the inventor of the microscope, Antony van Leeuwenhoek, and here's an illustration of his microscope and a diagram of what he found in his own samples of diarrhea, which were attributable to Giardia, a parasite that we can now explore in much more beautiful detail. These organisms have a lot of really fascinating stuff, including striking diversity of flagella, but also some things that are found only in this group of organisms, including an adhesive disc that's really of interest. We don't work on this now. These pictures are from Scott Dawson at UC Davis. They harbor two nuclei, and how those nuclei interact and talk to each other is something that isn't very well understood, or at least isn't very well understood by me.
Are those different species?
Which different species?
Are those different Giardia species?
These here, no, these are just, this is the same, these are actually the same organism, or no, these aren't, so these are scanning EM, so they can't be the same organism, but this is probably a single clonal isolate, and they're just spreading in different ways depending on how they're adherent and their cilia are organized in different ways. There are several different species, probably, of Giardia. They are there are, I think, five different what the Giardia community calls assemblages, which are probably species or would be defined as operational taxonomic units if they'd come from environmental sampling. We have genome sequence for all of those now. And in fact, one of the themes I want to come back to, I'll talk about a little bit from my own work, but something that has sort of surprised me in the last couple of weeks is that that it sort of is a useful reminder that people whose emphasis tends to be on things like animals or plants forget that we have a great deal of information about these microbial eukaryotes now. There are over 1,000 sequenced genomes for fungi. There are several hundred sequenced genomes for the Apicomplexa, which we worked on, several hundred sequenced genomes for the Kinetoplastida that Julius talked about. There are sequences for all the lineages we know about Giardia, as well as some related organisms, and we can maybe talk about that a little bit later on. Historically, we've also learned a lot about subcellular organelles from studying the chloroplast in Chlamydomonas and extensive studies on flagella. These are the trypanosomes that Julius talked about, bloodstream. Parasites responsible for sleeping sickness in humans and wasting disease in cattle in Ghana, and in a distantly related form responsible for Chagas disease in South America. This free-living bloodstream form here has a dramatic flagella, and there's a lot of really fascinating cell biology there. But I believe the mitochondrion was actually first discovered in these Kinetoplastida, first observed in the Kinetoplastida. It's certainly true that mitochondrial DNA was first discovered in the Kinetoplastida, and you can see why. This is the nucleus stained with DAPI, and this is the mitochondrion, or Kinetoplast, as it was originally described. And as Julius talked about last week, one of the remarkable things about this is that the reason its mitochondrial DNA was discovered is that it's packed full of vast amounts of DNA. In addition to the mitochondrial genome, lots of little mini circle genomes that are used for editing the primary transcripts to turn this unrecognizable form of ATP6, for example, into an arm in which U's are excised or added so that the mature form of the messenger RNA derives its protein sequences almost entirely contributed by these dramatically edited versions. And how and why this came about is a mystery we may not ever solve. But why it's maintained is probably easy to understand. Because having developed this remarkable process of editing, it would be difficult to get rid of it, right? ATP6 is an essential component of setting up establishing a proton gradient, and without this protein, it would be so. Having come up with this mechanism, all of the parasites responsible for this are probably stuck with it. My favorite parasite, I have to say, is an organism by the name of Tularia, which I would like to work on. We're not allowed to work on it in this country, but it's a protozoan parasite that transforms lymphocytes, so it causes lymphoma in cattle. It's one of the major reasons why it's difficult to graze cattle on the African veldt. These are our Tularia parasites, which do a dramatic job of modulating host cell signaling, corralling the centrosomes, and ensuring their division along with the transformed lymphocytes as they divide. This is from work from Dirk Dobelaer, who worked for many years in Kenya and then in Bern, and unfortunately passed away last year. Here's another parasite, a parasite by the name of Cryptosporidium, just in the process of beginning to divide. And it infects humans and probably most, if not all, mammals and various different species. Interacting with the brush border epithelium in the gut, and this is an intracellular parasite. This is the host cell membrane that it sort of pulled up over its head like a sheet, and how the parasite interacts with the lumen of the gut as opposed to the cytoplasm of the cell that it's associated with remains unknown. It seems quite likely that this is an actin pedestal analogous to the pedestal of enteropathogenic E. coli. But there's lots of work to be done and a lot of excitement in this area now for two reasons. First of all, because the first transfection systems have just been developed for Cryptosporidium. And secondly, because within the last couple of years, a set of really remarkable clinical studies supported by the Gates Foundation have revealed that Cryptosporidium is an under-recognized and underappreciated cause of diarrheal morbidity and mortality in infants around the world. I think it's number two or three on the list, say, after rotavirus. So there's a great deal of interest now in understanding Cryptosporidium. We have no drugs that are effective at eliminating these parasites. I wanted to mention that despite the fact that there's a vast array of eukaryotic diversity, we don't hear so much about most of these organisms. We hear more about fungi and metazoa, which are clearly sister taxa here. And for this paper we put together last year under Shelley and Mike's leadership, highlighted the fact that what we know from publications isn't necessarily reflected in what we know in the number of genomes that are available. Lots of genomes available for bacterial taxa here, relatively few for eukaryotes. That situation is changing. Last week, or 2 weeks ago, when Julius was here and talked about the TARA project for exploring microbial diversity in the oceans, he pointed out that while the number of defined species are divided between the animals, plants, and fungi that Linnaeus recognized from both terrestrial and marine sampling, we know that the diversity of life, even of eukaryotic life, is much larger than this would indicate. This was I stole this slide from Julius, or recreated it from something he sent me last week after his talk on the TARA project. So here are animals, fungi, and plants, and we can see that from biodiversity sampling, we can see some additional species most closely related to plants, the red algae, for example, and the Hacrobia. Other organisms more closely related to animals, including other opisthokonts, I guess misspelled here, including the coanoflagellates, and also more closely related the amoebae and probably the excavates. But this huge part of the here are organisms we don't hear so much about, including the stromatopiles, which include organisms like the diatoms we heard about last week, or the kelp that you see out on the beach, which are not green algae, but are stromatopiles that have enslaved an alga for photosynthetic purposes. The alveolates, which I'll be talking about today, and which include dinoflagellates that we heard a little bit about last week from Jose, and ciliates that you've probably heard about from Mike and others, and the apic complexa I'll talk about, and the rhizaria, which remain undersampled. Despite the fact that not surprisingly, the number of available genomes that I pulled out this morning from looking at the NCBI taxonomy browser, which is an underrepresentation of available genomes, but still, not surprisingly, this picture reflects this one on the left, but there's a growth in the number of non-animal, plant, and fungal taxa, so that, as I indicated previously, there are now over 1,000 fully sequenced fungal genomes, there are over 100 fully sequenced apic complexan genomes, over 100 fully sequenced stromatopile genomes, And this is all done at the species level, at the level of individual genomes. We have now, I think, at last count, something like 2,500 completely sequenced Plasmodium falciparum genomes, and something like 100 from Toxoplasma.
Can you go back two slides?
Yeah, sure.
You just passed too quickly for me to...
Sure. This one here?
No, the one before. Yeah. So the bars on the bottom are mapping to the... to the tree of life on top?
That's right. So this was an effort to try to map a number of available genomes and number of available publications in PubMed to the various groups that are indicated here in colors. The excavates, which include things like the Giardia I showed that Viken asked about, and the flagellates like Kinetoplastida, the chromalveolates that include parasites I'll be talking about today, as well as kelp and diatoms, the archaeplastida, including both plants and red and green algae, the amoebae and slime molds, and epistaconts that include fungi and metazoa.
So most of the genomes are from the excavates?
No, most of these are bacterial. So sorry, this is part of the tree that I didn't include here. So this is archaea and bacteria. This is something we talked a little bit about last week in talking about tools. So one real challenge, of course, is how to ensure access to these things. So for the most extensive resource for looking at bacterial genomes is probably the RAS server that Rick Stevens's group at Argonne has set up. And for all the however many thousands of genomes that are available at GenBank for bacterial genomes, there's close to an order of magnitude more completed genomes that have been submitted for annotation but haven't been placed into the public domain. And I argued last week, and I'd certainly be happy to talk to you or anybody else about strategies for trying to ensure things get into the public domain. And in my view, the limitation is not people's willingness to provide data, but just the challenge is making it easy. And I'll say maybe a little bit more about that later on, about eukaryotic genomes with some of the resources that we provide. Needless to say, feel free to interrupt any time, and we can take discussions off on whatever tangent is appropriate, and stop whenever we get tired. Okay, so here's another view of the same and one of the spectacular advances emerging from genome sequence data is the resolution that we have of deep eukaryotic evolution. It wasn't very long ago. I mean, I remember as a assistant professor, when we were doing some work on the cytoskeleton of the organisms that we work on, and being rather surprised that the phylogeny has told me fungi were clearly more closely related to animals than they were to other taxa, which was a surprise to me. And that was a topic of hot debate at the time. But now the grouping in the epistaconts or uniconts of animals with fungi is very well established. I don't think that it's questioned by anyone. And virtually all the nodes on this tree are now quite well supported. In fact, this picture, which I stole from Patrick Keeling a couple of years ago, is now out of date. We have a little bit more resolution. It's clear that the plants are more closely related to the chromalveolates than they are to these other taxa here. The excavates are probably more closely related to the uniconts. We have greater resolution to say, for example, that in the apicomplexa that we work on, that the dinoflagellates are more closely related to the apicomplexa, and ciliates probably form an outgroup here. And we have additional sequences that help to break up some of these long branches here. So I think that there are relatively few questions that remain about the overall large-scale taxonomy here, which is fantastic because it allows us to focus on what many of us are most interested in, which is what the biological differences are and what mediate the functional differences between these organisms and these, or these and these, and so on around the tree. My lab has worked on parasites in the phylum Apicomplexa. This is a group that I used to say contained more than 5,000 named species. It still contains more than 5,000 named species, but the best estimates now from environmental sampling is that there are probably over 1 million species of apicomplexans on Earth. There are probably no metazoa that are not parasitized by apicomplexa. All of these organisms are parasites, and they include a number that we care a fair bit about. This is a Plasmodium parasite responsible for malaria. There are many hundreds of species of Plasmodium parasite. You can see that they're clearly eukaryotes with all the organelles we've come to know and love, the nucleus and the Golgi and specialized secretory organelles, a mitochondrion, and even a plastid that I'll say a word or two about. These parasites are responsible for a lot of human disease and suffering. We've also worked on Toxoplasma, and another intracellular parasite. All of the apicomplexa are intracellular parasites, here shown living inside the vacuole that the parasite establishes for itself. In this case, a human cell, a human nucleated human cell, not a red blood cell. Toxoplasmosis is best known as a source of congenital neurological birth defects and fetal abortions, and also as an opportunistic pathogen associated with AIDS. One of the things that was interesting to me when I first started working, getting interested in this area, is that the concept of model organisms, which is so well established and I think widely accepted by anyone here, has not been as widely applied in the infectious disease world, probably because, similar as Toxoplasma and malaria parasites are, the diseases they cause are very different. So we've used Toxoplasma as a model to study Plasmodium, but toxoplasmosis is no model for malaria as a disease. But biologically, there's a lot of insight that we can gain from laying these life cycles on top of each other and comparing Tularia, those parasites that transform bovine lymphocytes, and Plasmodium parasites that are transmitted through mosquitoes and infect human red blood cells and cause a variety of illness, severe anemia, and so on. Toxoplasma, congenital neurological defect, Cryptosporidium that causes this diarrheal diseases. They're transmitted by different organisms and have many differences, but there also are many kinds of similarities that I won't really be talking about too much today. I will introduce you a bit to the biology of Toxoplasma, partly just because I like this slide, but I won't be talking much about the clinical aspects of it. So the parasite is intracellular. It infects virtually any nucleated cell, in contrast to organisms like Plasmodium, which are consummate specialists. A single species infects only a single tissue in a single organism. Plasmodium falciparum will infect humans and great apes, but not other monkeys. Toxoplasma, a single species, as far as we know, infects essentially any warm-blooded organism on Earth and some that are not so warm-blooded. It will infect frogs and chickens and whales and humans and cats and dogs, all from a single species. Intracellularly, it replicates synchronously to form here 16 parasites. So the parasite invades. It's a specialized invasion machine. Replicates intracellularly. If we come back to cells in culture or to an infected animal the next day, we'll see nothing like this. This tissue has all been destroyed. Yeah, Cassandra?
They infect lots of animals that are all vertebrates?
It infects only vertebrates. Yeah, we worked really hard to try to infect flies, for example.
Hey, leave it alone.
Yeah, they'll infect. We can infect fly cells, but we can't maintain it in flies. No,
Can you tell something just about that organization of the cells?
This here, yeah. So these are 16 parasites that are replicating, and their apical end is always facing out. And I'll tell you a little bit more about how they replicate, since that's an area we're working on now and that I'm most enthusiastic about, They're highly polarized organisms, and they replicate by a really distinctive mechanism that you in particular will probably be interested in, and we can talk more about. I should also say that work on the replication mechanism on Toxoplasma in my lab was started by a former graduate student, Ke Hu, who's going to be here, I think, next week or the week after, and I think now a colleague of Mike's in Indiana. But this is how parasites replicate asexually. They'll do it forever in culture. They'll do it forever in an organism until they run out of space. And this raises actually an important point, which is that in contrast to many other infectious disease organisms, all pathogenesis is a consequence of replication. So we really care about replication, right? It's not, so in contrast to the trypanosomes that Julia's talked about, or Leishmania, which are related parasites where disease is largely a consequence of immunopathogenesis. These guys, if we could stop them from replicating, we could stop the diseases that they cause. This is what a picture looks like in a cell culture flask. This is what a picture looks like in the eye of a child with congenital toxoplasmosis, which affects about 1 per 1,000 live births in the U.S. So it's a pretty widespread infection. And the parasite causes damage here to the retina. Infection during congenital infection is a major cause of hydrocephaly and so the problems like you see here. These parasites are controlled in outside of the CNS, are effectively controlled by the immune response, but they also differentiate into a latent cyst form here. This is actually at a lower magnification. These cysts can be as large as a millimeter across, and there are hundreds to thousands of parasites here from the cyst isolated from the brain of a mouse, but they also insist in any tissue of any of those vertebrates which have been infected, providing the most common source of recrudescence in immunosuppressed individuals. So Toxoplasma was one of the defining agents in recognizing HIV/AIDS, as latent cysts reemerge to give rise to this acute disease. And those cysts in tissues explain what is probably the dominant form of transmission through carnivory. So if you eat rare meat, you're likely to be infected with Toxoplasma, not just humans, but cats or any other animal that eats rare meat, particularly lamb or pork is most likely to be infected. The parasite also undergoes sexual replication only in cat intestinal epithelium and only once for reasons that we don't understand. And I've spent way too much time trying to get sexual replication to occur in the lab. The very first experiment I ever did on Toxoplasma was when I looked at something like this in pictures and said, these guys, this looks just like a yeast ascus, and we ought to be able to dissect that apart and isolate haploid sporozoites. And we did that successfully, and we're able to show that these two bags here, each of which contain four haploid sporozoites, are the division between them is the product of meiosis I. It turned out it didn't really bring the power of yeast genetics to work on Toxoplasma, because if we have to go through a cat every time we do a cross, we're not likely to assign thousands of things to complementation groups. Fortunately, the molecular genetic tools that we developed make it possible to avoid that, so we can still treat these parasites more or less the way we would yeast or worms or flies or whatever your favorite genetic system might be. Because they infect cats, go through a sexual cycle there. The oocysts are shed out in the feces when a cat gets infected, so 6 to 8 weeks after this cat gets its first infection from a mouse, it will shed probably tens of billions of oocysts out into the environment where they are stable essentially forever. So I did a cross with Toxoplasma when I first set up my lab, And the oocysts that we generated, which have been sitting in one normal sulfuric acid ever since, are 100% viable 25 years later. They've also, you can store them in 1% azide or in straight bleach out of the bottle. They're pretty inert. So for those of you who've been feeling pleased with yourself that you're not at risk because you don't eat meat, sadly, exposure to soil or contaminated water is another source of infection. So this explains the ubiquity of toxoplasma, which infects about 20 to 30% of the world's population. Obviously, there are not many of us who don't eat meat, drink water, or eat vegetables. And all of these are possible sources of infection.
Is this the only apicomplex able to produce a resistant latent cell, a dormant cell?
There are other related coccidia that do as well. Hammondia and Sarcocystis also form these kind of tissue cysts or bredizoites, as they're called. Plasmodium also has a latent stage, right? In Plasmodium vivax, the liver stage of the parasite forms a latent and form in the liver and can reemerge many months or even years later. That's why if you've ever had malaria, the Red Cross doesn't want your blood for fear about recrudescence. Now, it occurs at a different stage of the life cycle. The analogous stage would be, it would basically be something like this here in Plasmodium. We've done some looking to see whether there are similar, so we've done a lot of work on bredizoite differentiation that I won't talk about today, but I'm happy to talk about if you're interested. And we've done some work to try to compare whether the cyst stages of Plasmodium are similar to the cyst stages of Toxoplasma. They don't seem to be transcriptionally or from the standpoint of drug susceptibility. But obviously, this issue of latency in plant seeds or in fungal spores or in TB cysts is a general phenomenon for organisms that face multiple different environments, including harsh environments. And I think there's some interest in comparing between them. Okay. So in my lab, we've certainly been interested in organismal diversity, and it's been a lot of fun to explore both common aspects of eukaryotic biology, such as how vesicular trafficking systems operate, and how the dramatic microtubule architecture of these organisms is structured. And we've also looked at novel aspects, both because it opens our eyes to the diversity of eukaryotic life and also as potential targets for therapeutic intervention. And I'll tell you a little bit about this process here of how parasites divide. So Shelley, you were asking earlier, here are four parasites, a little earlier than that other stage that showed 16. The apical end here is stained in green, and the basal end is stained in yellow, and you can see the daughters being assembled inside the mother in a sort of unusual process that we'll talk a little bit more about in a minute. So as I mentioned, there's a lot of interesting cell biology associated with these parasites, and while I would obviously be happy to talk at much greater length than any of you wants to hear about any aspects of things on this slide, including their association with the host cell. This is a host cell mitochondrion, and these specialized secretory organelles that come in two flavors, one's known as the rope trees and the micronemes here. These are adhesive, these secrete adhesins, and these help to establish the intracellular environment, this parasitophorous vacuole in which the parasites reside. Other cytoskeletal structures, such as this conoid, the organization of that spiral that a skeletal structure you might have noticed on the last picture, in which Kerr actually worked on as a graduate student in the lab. Or common aspects in biology, including the organization of the ER and the nucleus and the Golgi. I really want to try to touch on things that specifically relate to the way we try to approach evolutionary cell biology, and particularly questions that might enlist or engage the interests and expertise of people who approach these from a more quantitative direction. I mentioned that these parasites also have a plastid organelle that was acquired by secondary endosymbiotic transfer. This has been mentioned a couple of times in this series here, is that this is a secondary endosymbiont. The ancestor of these parasites ate a eukaryotic alga, or was invaded by the alga, giving rise to this organelle, which is structured exactly as you might expect. It's surrounded by four membranes betraying its ancestry as an endosymbiont of a eukaryote that had previously acquired a plastid from a cyanobacterium. This is work we did quite a few years ago in an effort to try to understand the mechanism of action of macrolide antibiotics, which are normally thought of as classic prokaryotic protein synthesis inhibitors. We naively thought that there must be something prokaryotic-like about the cytoplasmic ribosomes. In fact, the ribosomes in question are the organellar ribosomes associated with this structure. The phylogeny told us that this was clearly a secondary endosymbiont along the lines of by looking at the topologies along the lines of what we heard about from Paul last week, that the apicomplexa here branch out from within the plants and algae, quite distinct from mitochondria or cyanobacterium, and we were able to localize this by a variety of standard imaging approaches and cut-and-paste molecular genetic approaches that allowed us to define the motifs that are responsible for targeting and identify the metabolic functions of the organelle. So we now have a complete metabolic pathway map for this organelle. It's involved in three things: in synthesizing lipids via a type 2 fatty acyl synthase, distinct from the way humans synthesize fatty acids. They synthesize isoprenoids via a xylulose pathway, which is distinct from the way we synthesize isoprenoids. And this organelle plays a part of a role in synthesizing heme. Identifying the functions of this organelle in an organism where we couldn't purify grams of material was initially challenging, but the most successful approaches for identifying all of these targets, several of which indicated by sort of skull and crossbones here, the target for therapeutic investigations, not in my lab, but by various pharmaceutical companies. The most successful approach was to try to combine what we could gain from our understanding of targeting motifs and phylogenies in a computational analysis to identify proteins associated with the apicoplast. In the initial run, we identified several hundred. There are a few more now, but in the first iteration of our computational analysis of the then incomplete genomes for Toxoplasma and Plasmodium, we define what is essentially the complete metabolic pathway map that we know today. We didn't necessarily know what all of these genes do, which led us to the problem of orthology, which has been discussed obliquely by many people in many talks, and I think warrants a little bit detailed discussion. This will certainly come up later on. I know Gene Coonan is coming out later on. Gene was responsible for the first use of blast-based analysis to identify orthologs in bacterial taxa. By orthologs, what we mean are genes that arose by virtue of speciation as opposed to duplication and potentially functional divergence. The concept being is that if there was a single gene that was present that diverged only by virtue of speciation, we're more likely to be able to infer something about function in the blue organism here based on what was present in the red organism, in contrast to paralogs that duplicated here in the green organism, and one or the other of these may well have diverged. The concept of looking at reciprocal best blast hits in these sort of triangle-type organizations underlies the strategy for identifying COGS. This works extremely well in most bacterial sequences for a variety of reasons. It works less well in eukaryotes for a variety of reasons, including the incomplete nature of genome sequences, the inadequate nature of genome assembly, the inadequacies of existing annotation, particularly in organisms with where genes are extensively fragmented by large introns. But eukaryotes have other problems as well, including their large genomes with extensive gene duplication and change, and complicated protein domain structures in ways we've heard about from Emmanuel and from others, and will be familiar to people here. And this led us a long time ago to try to address some of these problems by modifying the COG approach for eukaryotes, and this is the subject of a long series of work that gave rise to the OrthoMCL algorithm, a pretty simple-minded algorithm that really just applied three fundamental changes to what was previously used for bacteria. The first of which was that rather than looking for reciprocal best blast hits, we're looking for reciprocal hits that are better to anything outside in that species than to anything within the species. The problem is easy to see. You can imagine if there's an extensive duplication, and in species A, we have gene A1 that is duplicated to give rise to A2, and in species E, we have gene A1 that is duplicated to give rise to B2. And all of these are derived from a single common ancestor. If A points to B1 as its best hit, and B1 to A2, and A2 to B2, and to A1, we'll have no reciprocal best hits. But so long as A1's match to so long as A1's match to B2 is better than its match to B1. We'll group all of these together in the same group. The second thing that we did was in running an all-against-all blasts analysis for all organisms with complete genome sequences, is to normalize edge weights between species. So before grouping things together, we're going to treat every species as if it is equally far apart from every other species, despite the fact that obviously humans and mice are more closely related to each other than either is to Saccharomyces. And this compensates for a whole variety of sins, including differences in genome organization and nucleotide composition. Yeah.
I've never understood, if you're going to get to this point, why don't you just use phylogenetics to...
We do generate phylogenies for these. I mean, the challenges for phylogeny based, there's several challenges for phylogeny based ortholog assignment, not least of which is the challenge of multiple sequence alignment, right? So as you are undoubtedly aware, as many people are aware, generating a proper multiple sequence alignment is a huge challenge. There are also computational limitations on the kinds of things that we can do. So we generally do that downstream, but there are certainly phylogeny-based methods for taking a look at that. And I'd be happy to talk to you later about what the performance of some of these looks like. There's this. Probably here. This plus one paper here by Feng Chen looked at developed a benchmarking algorithm and compared blast-based approaches with phylogeny-based approaches. In our case, the driver for this was mostly something that we need to be able to do rapidly, and to scale to thousands of organisms. But I'll show you some phylogenies, or the results of some phylogenies in a minute. This is really just a way of getting a clue as to what's going on. And then we cluster these, and there are a variety of ways that you can cluster them, and we've implemented this into a database that's pretty widely used that allows people to interrogate on various things. I've talked to some people here about interrogating the OrthoMCL database to look for genes that are found in fungi but not animals, or in anaerobes but not aerobic organisms, or amplified in particular taxa. So you might imagine, for example, if we wanted to ask about the apicoplast, this plastid organelle acquired by horizontal transfer into apicomplexan parasites, we can ask for genes that are found in Plasmodium, Toxoplasma, Thyleria, but absent from Cryptosporidium, which has lost this organelle in a secondary loss. They're absent from Metazoa, but are present in at least one plant or alga taxa, and you can imagine configuring this query in various different ways. And this gives rise to a list here, the fairly old slide, with a limited number of taxa, but still a couple of hundred here. And we can look at the distribution, only as if this were live, a mouse over would indicate what the taxa are. The yellow arrows here, the green arrows here indicate true positives. Now that we know everything that this organelle does, there are certainly some false positives that, for whatever reason, show the same phylogenetic distribution, and that gave rise to this metabolic pathway map that I described previously, indicating type 2 fatty acyl synthase, xylulose biosynthesis, production of heme, and of course the replication of the organelle or genome, its transcription, which is the target of things like the target of drugs like rifamycins, and translation, which is the target of drugs like macrolide antibiotics. I should also mention that as with all endosymbiotic organelles, the vast majority of organelle associated functions are encoded in the nucleus and post-translationally imported into the organelle. I should have said this earlier. When we were trying to write, so what led us to this organelle originally was identifying the ribosomal targets which are encoded on the organelle or genome. We sequenced the organelle or genome, but it gave us no insights into function. All of the functional bits have been transferred to the nucleus and are post-translationally imported. I wasn't really planning on talking about the apicoplast, but in part driven by Val's discussion about horizontal transfer last week and Jose's interest in endosymbiosis, I thought I'd tell you one brief story that isn't yet published, and that raises some of the interesting questions we can ask about organisms like this. So here's an organism that in its ancestor presumably had a mitochondrion, and now it acquired an algal endosymbiont with its own mitochondrion as well as its own plastid. And you might imagine, and yet we don't see two mitochondria left. You might imagine that you'd like to know where these things came from. You'd like to know what the functions might be. It was a little bit of a surprise to find enzymes that appeared to be associated with heme biosynthesis associated with the apicoplast. And we originally assumed that those would be false positives on the side of computational screening that I described to you before. But in fact, they turn out to be true. So that raised the question as to where these came from. As you may know, we know how to synthesize heme in two different ways: the so-called C4 pathway, and that are used by animals and fungi, and the C5 pathway. This is based on glycine and succinate, and the C5 pathway with plants and algae start with glutamate, and they converge in the synthesis of porphobilinogen here by this enzyme aminolevulinic acid dehydratase, or porphobilinogen synthetase, depending on which way you're looking at the reaction. So we know for sure that the animal and fungal proteins derived from a proteobacterial ancestor, while the plant and algal pathway derives from a cyanobacterial ancestor. And the question is, what does an organism with both a plastid and a mitochondrion do? And analysis of the genomes makes it very clear that they do this. They have an amino levulinic acid synthase. They don't have the, they don't have this glutamate pathway present in plants. So there's no question that the that heme biosynthesis in apicomplexa occurs via this animal and fungal C4 pathway. But we also know that some of these enzymes are localized into the plastid. And that we discovered originally by looking at the genomes and tested this out by cloning all of the enzymes that are involved. Those are the ones shown, and then tagging them with a fluorescent tag or with an epitope tag, and then doing co-localization studies with either a mitochondrial marker or a plastid marker. The plastid markers are pretty easy to see. Here's a plastid marker, and clearly this enzyme, ALAD, is present in the apicoplast. The mitochondrial markers are a little more complicated. These are just rhodamine-based markers, and they label not only the single mitochondrion of the parasite, but also the host mitochondria here, which are plastered up around the parasitophorous vacuole. Still, I think it's clear that this enzyme shows this mitochondrial-type localization and co-localizes with mitochondria. This enzyme is present in the plastid, present in the plastid, present in the plastid. In the cytoplasm, distinct from the plastid here, this one's in the cytoplasm, distinct from the mitochondria, and now back into the mitochondria. Who knows why they do this, or even how it takes place, since the mechanisms of heme ring transport haven't been well worked out in any system. But we can say unequivocally from these kinds of studies that this is the organization. But that doesn't tell us necessarily about the ancestry, because you can imagine that that this proteobacterial ancestry, so the ancestral parasite, could have relocated these enzymes from the cytoplasm of the ancestor into the plastid, or alternatively, they could have kept the plastid enzymes and thrown out these original ones. And this is where we turn to more careful phylogenetic analysis to identify all of the appropriate things. And I'm not going to show you any trees of this, but anyone who'd like to look at them are welcome to do so. And they give us some pretty clear and sometimes surprising answers. First of all, these two enzymes are unequivocally of cyanobacterial origin. There's no question that ALAD and UROS in the apicomplexa, as in all plants and algae, derived from a cyanobacterial ancestor, and there's no evidence of the proteobacterial ancestor of these enzymes that are present in, say, our mitochondria. This enzyme derives from proteobacteria, and interestingly, not just in parasites, but also in plant and algal plastids, and this wasn't previously recognized. I think everyone had always assumed that the entire heme biosynthetic pathway is derived from cyanobacterium, but for reasons best known to the ancestral alga, at some point the mitochondrial, so there's a vestige of the mitochondrial ancestor that has been transferred into the chloroplast of plants and algae. Plants and algae do put heme into their mitochondria, of course, but they do so by duplicating these enzymes here. They're not the PPO and ferrochelatase are not of proteobacterial origin. They're of cyanobacterial origin. Most of the rest of these enzymes come from a proteobacterial ancestor. We don't have enough resolution to be able to identify the source of CPO. But interestingly, the last step in this pathway in apicomplexa comes from a proteobacterium, but from a different proteobacterium than the ancestor of mitochondria. So at some point, evolutionarily, there's a very clear phylogenetic signal that this enzyme came from a separate endosymbiotic colonization, and the tree architecture is pretty consistent with that. Yeah, Cassandra?
So is there any evidence that upon colonization of the cell by the algal cell, there was exchange of plastid genes between the mitochondria and the incoming algal cell?
Is there evidence for any plastid genes in the that are targeted to the mitochondria?
Yeah, or
so so it's likely that that happened. The signal is difficult to see. It's probably the best to look at, and we can pull out the trees if you want to take a look at them, are the tRNA synthetases, right? So if you synthesize proteins in the mitochondria and in the plastid and the cytoplasm, you need 60 tRNA synthetases. There are only, I think, 37 or something like that. We've owned them and generated trees for all of them. And there are all kinds of possible mutations and combinations in terms of what they do and where they come from. And there's some that are suggestive of plastid tRNA synthetases that have now taken over the mitochondrial function, but the signal isn't really great enough to take a look at. It would actually be really interesting to look at that in some of the earlier, deeper ancestors that we have from these, or descendants of those ancestors. So as I'll tell you in a minute, we now have sequences from a pre-parasitic or an apicomplexan that diverged from the rest of the lineage prior to the development of parasitism. It has a much more expanded genome, including both a functional plastid and mitochondrion. And it'd be really interesting to look at the tRNA synthetases there. We haven't done so. Okay, so the point here is that our ability to assign orthologs allowed us to ask a bunch of interesting evolutionary questions and also a bunch of interesting functional questions if you care about the biology of these bugs, which we do and you probably don't. But there's a lot more that we can do from the standpoint of ortholog detection, and this is sort of a slide that I put together for Hawks to an undergraduate computational biology class to sort of illustrate some of the things that I think are quite useful in looking at orthologs. And it's sort of a simple-minded analysis, but I'll take you through it. So imagine, for example, that you were a space alien who comes down to Earth, and you see all these organisms running around. You see humans and mice and malaria parasites and toxoplasma parasites and thousands of other organisms, and you'd like to know what makes them interesting and what makes them different, and you don't know anything about them except their genomes, and magically you can identify the genes, but of course you know nothing at all about function. And you can identify tens of thousands of genes in humans and in mice and thousands of genes in plasmodium and toxoplasma. But we can group them together by virtue of similarity, as you've already seen and certainly already knew. While we were raising this problem of porology and gene duplication as a complication in eukaryotes, it's also an opportunity to ask what genes these organisms have duplicated or have expanded in various different ways. And for all of these thousands of genes, which we can group into lower numbers of thousands of ortholog groups, there are only tens or hundreds of them that are expanded with multiple paralogs. And we can assign them, these are now genes rather than groups, we can assign the number of genes in these groups to ask when those duplications occurred on the phylogenetic tree. So what we're interested in doing is taking our phylogenetic tree and mapping features that occurred, such as the evolution of parasitism or the acquisition of a plastid or whatever other features we might want to ask. And we're asking for whether there are signatures of genome organization or gene presence and absence that might be informative to understand these biological features. So there are a relatively small number that distinguish, say, these vertebrates from these apicomplexa, and an even smaller number that distinguish, say, humans from mice. And if you ask what those genes are, this is what they are. So if you were to ask what distinguish humans and mice from Plasmodium and Toxoplasma, by virtue of gene duplication, your attention would immediately be drawn to MHC antigens and immunoglobulins. Now, you might argue that that's sort of cheating. I mean, we know that these genes are dramatically altered and there's been extensive duplication, but that's really the point, right? The point is that if you wanted to try to understand what distinguished these organisms from these, this wouldn't be a terrible place to start. What's more, if these hypothetical space aliens were to ask, by virtue of taxon-specific gene duplication, what distinguishes humans from mice, this would be what would come up as the top on your list. Olfactory receptors in mice and vision receptors in humans. And again, I'd submit, if you really want to know what distinguishes humans from mice, that would be a pretty good place to start. You wouldn't know what these things did, but they certainly would be worth exploration. If we do the same kind of experiment for Plasmodium and Toxoplasma, we identify the proteins that are involved in adhesion and invasion as distinct from other, not just humans and mice, but other taxa as well, and a group of proteins called the alveolins, which I'll talk about in a couple of minutes if I have time. And if you ask about the distinction between Plasmodium and Toxoplasma, your attention is drawn to various surface antigens that people are interested in from the standpoint of understanding pathogenesis or developing vaccine targets. And interestingly, a group of enzymes that are eukaryotic protein kinases.
Move on that slide. I just wanted to double check if I understood that correctly. When you have the number 893 and you include the immunoglobulins as being a big component, are you calling the immunoglobulins one of those 893?
So these are
a lot of them.
So these are actually, I think these are actually groups. I'm trying to think. I would have to do the distinction between these, but these are groups rather than genes. So many of them are paralogous genes that have been grouped into the same group. So I'd have to. I should really regenerate
but
the slide.
But at some
this
level,
is,
it's unclear. But
right. Okay. So what the meaning is as to what gets grouped into a group, as I think we talked about last week, I think Paul had brought this up, where you set your cutoff between lumping and splitting groups is a long-standing problem in tree construction or clustering, and there's no clear right or wrong answer, but we're using the same criteria for distinguishing these. And we can take a look at these later on if you want to see what else is in here. And there are many other ways that you can take a look at this. I mean, I was struck by a conversation with a mosquito biologist a couple of years ago. You might imagine working on malaria, I wind up in meetings with a bunch of people who are mosquito biologists, but I know nothing at all about mosquito biology or genomes, aside from the fact that they make my life hell in Philadelphia ever since an 80s Albopictus moved into the Philadelphia area. We can't eat out in our garden anymore. But you know, we tried to do the same experiment asking not what distinguishes humans from mice, but what distinguishes Drosophila from Anopheles gambi. And not surprisingly, what distinguishes it, again, are odorant receptors, but particular classes of odorant receptors, and those turn out to be odorant receptors that are well known as distinguishing behavioral differences between flies and mosquitoes. And now you can play this game with Culex versus Aedes and Anopheles with new genomes. Yeah.
This is probably a stupid question, but what is the evidence that orthologous genes, paralogous genes evolve new functions more often than orthologous genes?
So it's an interesting question, and lots of people have looked into this. We spent quite a bit of time on this. So Feng Chen, who I'd mentioned, developed these benchmarking algorithms. He's actually a structural chemist and spent a lot of time trying to look at this, asking it. So one of the ways we did this was in a joint project with Andre Schally and David Baker, was to take a look at how much we care about orthology as inferred from sequence in structural determination. So we assembled groups of, for all available structures in PDB, for which we could assign by sequence-based methods, not by structural methods, orthologous pairs and paralogous pairs, and asked what the implications are on structure. And I can pull out the actual numbers for this, but the answer was that what sequence, to a first approximation, what sequence-based methods defined as orthology gained you about 0.6 angstroms in the active site in terms of structure, or something like 15% in sequence identity. So the conclusion from that was that in this global analysis, what we called orthologs versus paralogs were worth, you know, 15% in sequence identity in terms of their ability to predict structure. So there are lots of interesting questions you could ask about how and why and when duplication does or doesn't lead to neo-functionalization. And there's certainly other people who've thought about that a lot more than I have, although I'll give you an example in a minute.
So the other 85%, they're diverging in active site?
Huh? No, sorry. The 15% in sequence, so basically, if you're interested in trying to create a structural model, and I can give you what we would call an ortholog in another species, or something that is a paralog, the question is how much do you care? So let's say I could give you an orthologue that had 60% sequence identity, and something that we'd call a paralogue that had 70% sequence identity. Would you prefer the higher sequence identity, or would you prefer what appears to be an orthologue? And the answer is that obviously averaged across all those groups, you'd be willing to give up 15% sequence identity in order to pick an orthologue rather than a paralogue. Does that make sense? Or alternatively, you would lose...
That's got to be only... I mean, that can only really be true at a certain level. I mean, you give the example of 60 versus 70, and I'm...
So we, of course, looked at it across a wide range. It depends on the level of... I think it's probably fair to say that if you had a paralog that was 100% identical in sequence, you would rather base your structure on that than on a putative orthologue that was 85% identical. I'm happy to give you the graph. Actually, for anyone who's particularly interested in this, let me know, because I should give you the relevant chapter from Feng's thesis, which we never published and is way better than the work that we did publish on that. It's just much higher resolution.
But isn't there there's still another issue, right? Because just because they share the same structure doesn't mean they have the same function.
True. So, there are lots of issues here in terms of structure and function and how to predict this. And another aspect of what Feng did that was actually, I found, quite intriguing was, and which is also unpublished, but wasn't in his thesis, was to distinguish between active site residues and buried residues and surface residues, and observed, as other people have as well, a much more rapid divergence in active site residues in paralogs than in orthologs, presumably a manifestation of neo-functionalization. So, and how that manifests itself in the protein as a whole is complicated.
So is it true then that, a common textbook thing is that paralogous genes, they diverge by, genes that are duplicated, they diverge more in function versus orthologous genes.
Right.
And there's no real hard evidence on that, really?
So I don't think that's true. I think that there's actually pretty good evidence on. There are lots of challenges here, right? I mean, including what counts as a paralog, right? I mean, since one man's paralog is another's ortholog, I might consider alpha tubulin and beta tubulin to be the result of a paralogous, different groups, but they arose by virtue of duplication at some point. So from the perspective of a bacterium, they're just paralogous duplications. So what we consider an ortholog and what we consider a paralog depends on the taxonomic set that we're including. But I think it's true, and probably other people here, maybe Emmanuel or Mike or others could comment, that it's generally true that you see substantially more rapid diversification in paralogs. There are many complicating factors. In the example I'll show you in just a minute, where there's been a massive paralogous duplication in this group of proteins, these kinases here that are taxons, sort of taxon-specific amplification. Many of them are pseudogenes, and obviously they're under different selective constraints than things that have function.
Can I ask just another layer of complexity? There's actually a study, I think it was published a few years ago in Plus Competition Biology, where people actually addressed this problem of function conservation in paralogs versus orthologs. And they surprisingly conclude that paralogs are more likely to have the same function versus orthologs. But I think the issue is, what do you mean by function here? So what these guys were doing was mapping this to Go, and then you can choose process versus molecular function versus localization, and I don't even think there's anything intrinsically right or wrong about how you do this. It's just
that paper was actually a really poor paper, as has been pretty extensively debunked by a number of other people. So they assessed function based on expression profiling data, and based on the Go assignments, and they had terrible sampling biases from things that were quite closely related. So there are quite a few people who've published sort of rebuttals on that. The best is probably from Tony Gabaldon's paper, but we also published something on it. Someone else did as well. So that was, I think, that muddied the water quite a bit.
I think we're talking about Matt Hahn's work, right? And I think he's even given up on that.
Yeah.
True. Last time I talked to him.
Yep. Yeah, so it was an interesting idea. It's just there were some unstated assumptions that they hadn't really adequately thought through. Okay, let me tell you a little bit about, so this is your uppermost.
As you were listing these species-specific differences or duplications, there seems to be quite a lot of, at least just from this shallow list that you're showing here, duplication of genes that are involved in somehow interacting, sensing the world.
Right.
Is this just something, is a small number effect, just out of this, or is this a trend that you see in the...
Probably true. I mean, you can make good arguments for why it might be true. I'll give you an argument here. Certainly, if you are a unicellular organism that lives as a parasite, finding and attaching to and invading and subverting and or getting along with a cell is central to your existence. I'm not quite sure how you'd actually ask what the abundance of that is. I can tell you, for example, that that in these organisms, as well as in other intracellular parasites, that you find a much higher fraction of the genome that is secreted, and presumably helps to modulate host cell functions. You find a higher proportion that are have adhesive domains. I mean, these are sort of consistent with that argument, but I'm not really sure how to test it further. So they suggest, I mean, so certainly, I mean, this caught our eye because we all know quite a bit about eukaryotic protein kinases, and in general, when we think of eukaryotic protein kinases, they are signaling molecules that play a role in mediating signaling, generally intracellular signaling. I defy you to name a secreted eukaryotic protein kinase from any vertebrate, for example. As far as I'm aware, there aren't any that have been described. Here's a phylogeny based on the protein kinase domain for all human Arabidopsis yeasts, Plasmodium and Toxoplasma kinases, and they group into familiar families of kinases, including the calmodulin kinases and the TK-like kinases and the CMGC kinases. Both Plasmodium in pink and Toxoplasma in red have amplified and independently amplified protein kinases, which have signal sequences, as indicated by the red dots on the outside. And what's more, we know that they are actually secreted outside of the parasite from work in other labs, as from work in Arthur Scherf's lab in Paris, or in work in John Boothroyd's lab at Stanford in Toxoplasma, and Jeroen Tsai at MIT in Toxoplasma, where here's a host cell nucleus, parasites being this, and you can see that this particular parasite protein traffics to the host cell nucleus, where it's not too hard to imagine that it might play an important role. Furthermore, we know from genetic studies on virulence carried out mostly by David Sibley at WashU that this mapped a particular gene that had been studied by your colleague Zay and Monica Jonathan Howard as a target for and I'm involved in virulence. So we set about to try to characterize that family member and defined an HMM that distinguishes it from the standard eukaryotic protein kinases. The red dots again indicate secretory signal sequences, and we could clearly define these. A bunch of these were inaccurate gene models, and gave rise to the following phylogeny. So all of these genes are duplicated from a single protein in the common ancestor of these coccidian parasites. Most, probably all of them, have a secretory signal sequence. All of those that we were able to localize, we were able to localize to these specialized secretory organelles. And when we looked at signatures of selection initially via a convoluted way, but now that we have a couple hundred sequences from diverse isolates around the world, we can look for signatures of selection, which are those indicated by stars. And we see a number that appear to be under diversifying selection. The tick marks here indicate genes that have been points of duplication or X's loss in comparison with a closely related outgroup, Neospora, which is a cattle pathogen. This is my favorite family here, a gene that has been independently triplicated in both Toxoplasma and Neospora, one member of which retains higher similarity at the protein level than at the nucleotide level, and the other ones appear to have diverged, and we now know from knockout studies that this is the only one of these three that is essential, although all three knockouts give a fitness effect. So the point, and all of this work has been published, but the point was that whereas in the apical blast story I told you about, we wanted to be able to use orthology to predict function, in this story, in these secretory eukaryotic protein kinases, we want to use perology to be identified, families to tell us something that the parasite seems to be doing interesting things with. This is a family of proteins that's under intensive study in the toxoplasma field, and many rope 18 and 16 were defined as virulence loci, rope 5. Several of these are known to be really critically important for interactions with the host cell.
I'm just extrapolating, but this is exactly, and this is obviously a very interesting situation. But it would seem to me that if you imagine this evolving further back in time, such that the nucleotide tree is no longer informative, except what's contained in the protein tree, you would definitively get the wrong answer when you did actually also either a tree or a blast.
Right. So when your nucleotide signal has decayed beyond the ability to resolve, you're likely to get mistaken inferences if you're using orthology to define evolution as opposed to function. Right. So.
Well, if it's function, it's not orthology.
Right. Well, so the point is that that we would still in this particular case where there's a single common ancestor that's been independently triplicated, they're all paralogs. But this issue of duplication and separate loss. So if these loss didn't function, it'd be difficult for us to know what the common ancestor was and when that arose. And this is, I'm not articulating this very well, but this is certainly a well-known problem, right, of parallel independent losses or divergence beyond the point where we can recognize common ancestry.
And this seems like a good illustration of why you might not want to maybe so easily call things orthologs versus paralogs based on sequence similarity.
Yeah, so sequence similarity, so orthology calls are used for different purposes. In fact, most commonly, right, now we use orthology calls to say, not to say anything about evolution, but to infer function. That violates the sort of strict definition of orthology, which refers to protein evolution. Either way, they're certainly subject to all kinds of problems, right? The case that I'm arguing here is really a very simplistic one, which is from among the tens of thousands of genes in the genome, we're looking to ask what genes or gene families or nucleotides or amino acids or whatever this organism seems to care about. What is showing diversification or conservation that suggests it might be interesting in a way that we can test experimentally.
Because your goal is to find out the function of these things.
So our goal is to try to find out the function of these things. Our goal here is less what the true tree is than it is to try to figure out which of these things might be informative from, can we get any insight from the patterns of conservation that we see, or the patterns of evolution that we see or suspect, that will give us insights into the function of these proteins in organismal biology. Does that make sense?
So if we want to sort of maybe reframe it, instead of calling these clusters of orthologous groups, we might call them clusters of reciprocal most similar groups, which might be due to orthology, it might be due to shared conserved function.
That's fair enough.
Or
right?
Both. So that might be better. What it bugs me about is you call them orthologous and it's sort of begging some of these questions.
But the same applies for tree-based approaches as well. For one of my There's a famous example in one of my favorite proteins, which Shelley and I both worked on many years ago, on dihydrofolate reductase, where we can say where the N-terminal alpha helix of the protein forms part of the active site. And there's a sort of there's a loop prior to that protein, and several times independently in evolution you will see a shift back and forth between what forms that site, and therefore a change in the selective constraints on what you observe, so that the so this is at least at an amino acid level you can see some clear examples of convergence in and so the debate about whether sequence similarity or functional conservation or structural conservation or evolutionary history, you know, which is the right tree, doesn't really apply. I mean, if you're assembling a tree for something, you're assuming consistent evolutionary constraints on all on the different parts of what you're trying to build your tree for, and that has changed over time.
Yeah.
So I take your point, and I agree with you that what we're really doing here is and it's why I wanted to show you how we've assigned these groups, right? So we're assigning groups of proteins based on sequence similarity, manipulated in various different ways to improve the signal from the standpoint of inferring likely function. And that may or may not tell us anything about the actual history of those proteins. But I guess I would argue that to some extent the same thing is true here. I mean, here, for example, right, this tree is telling us something different about ancestry from this tree. So what we will infer. So we believe this tree. We have enough. This is recent enough, and we have sampled deeply enough that we believe this nucleotide tree. If we didn't have that, we would draw the wrong tree here. But this tree is probably more informative from the standpoint of function.
Well, I mean, one problem a lot of particular gene families is you retain a lot of gene conversion for a very long period of time.
Yep.
So in paramecium and in yeast, you'll clearly get phylogenies that look like this all the time.
Yep.
And if you start doing, you know, the genealogy of the whole region the gene is in, you can figure things out. But often you'll get this kind of tree structure that will look exactly like this. Everything within a species will be more or less in one group, and that's not the true genealogy.
Yep. No, I mean, we've encountered that, I mean, as you might imagine, for a lot of the things we're interested in looking at. We've often been interested in asking about ciliate paralogs, and have encountered exactly this problem for paramecium or tetrahymena. It's just, I mean, the phylogeny of tetrahymena and paramecium snare proteins, for example, is just a nightmare. You get these clearly erroneous things where everything in tetrahymena is most similar to everything else in tetrahymena. This phenomena, this step that I described of normalizing across species differences actually recovers quite a lot of signal from that, but not enough for, so this does actually a surprisingly good job of, good job as assessed by functional studies, of grouping ciliate kinases. Not such a good job on the snare proteins, for example.
At the end of the day, it kind of doesn't matter which of the questions it answers, because you're just using this as a way to generate hypotheses that you'll then test about how the protein
works. Yep, exactly.
You're not
for us. But the point is a good one, that if we're going to say that these are orthologs as opposed to groups that were identified by this algorithm, that can be misleading. I'm not claiming that, but I've still talked about them as orthologs.
Well, you could just change your word.
I mean, I disagree. These are the interesting things that determine the hypotheses. I mean, knowing where they come from and how they evolved according to their function over time is, those are the hypotheses. And
but between the two trees and the pink box down there, it would really just, it would come down to the details of the specific amino acid changes that you would predict I would have to change or not change in my functional assay. Those might not be seriously different between the left and right trees there or topologies there in the pink box.
So Shelley's pointing out that we're out of time. So I want to take just the last couple of minutes. I'm happy to talk about any of this later on. And the third story that I wanted to tell you, I won't have a chance to talk about now, but that's fine. We can talk about it later on. I'll give a quick taste of what that's like and want to just end with a couple of conclusions. The last thing that I'd wanted to talk to you about was this business of how parasites divide. And sorry, Shelley, this is what you're most interested in, but we can talk about it later on. It's a really fascinating process in which parasites assemble daughters within the mother. So it's conceptually more analogous to kind of a viral burst than it is to division by binary fission. I mean, I know yeast people make a big deal between budding yeast and fission yeast. As far as I'm concerned, they're all the same, right? I mean, meaning everything that was in the mother winds up in one of the two daughters, or a mother and a daughter. But that's not the case here, right? Whatever is left over is thrown off. So what's left in the daughter is everything that goes into the daughter is a positive decision. But that has some really bizarre implications from the standpoint of understanding a cell cycle. Parasites divide over the course of about 7 hours, and what we think of as the hallmark of S phase are completely subsumed into all of the processes that we generally think of as M phase, which basically takes up 80% of the cell cycle. The most informative way of understanding this, and remember, we care a lot about this because division is what causes pathogenesis. So the most informative thing of looking at this is this inner membrane complex that the parasite uses to divide. So these are two parasites, and here's the plasma membrane, but underneath the plasma membrane are two other membranes, which are a series of flattened vesicles of the inner membrane complex. You can see a parasite dividing. Here's the nucleus dividing. Nice closed mitosis, Shelley. Here's the plastid slipping in. This is the inner membrane complex, these flattened vesicles. And you can see so there's no plasma membrane. Here's the mother's plasma membrane and the flattened vesicles of the daughter. This process so those flattened vesicles are the alveoli that give rise to the name that groups ciliates, dinoflagellates, and apicomplexans, but they're used for very different purposes. In ciliates, they're used for homeostasis, particularly for water control. In dinoflagellates, they're used for storing the calciferous plates that give rise to the remarkable structures that Jose showed last week. In apicomplexans, they're used for division. And now with sequence information that allows us to break up some of these long branches, we would like to ask, what happened here? And one thing we can say, this is looking at ortholog groups as defined by this ortho-MCL string. And at precisely the stage that parasitism developed, there are many ortholog groups that are lost and a few that are gained. We're interested in trying to understand what those are and what insight they can give us. And among other things, they highlight the presence of these alveolins, these intermediate filament proteins, structurally intermediate filaments. They're not orthologous to keratins or other intermediate filaments in say mammalian cells or in animals. And these sort of violin plots take all of the ortholog groups that we can assign and ask when they arose in the evolution from the phylum level down through the species or the genus or species level. And this size of this indicates the number of groups that arose. So this shows the position at which distinctive family of transcription factors arose in this lineage. This shows an evolution of these cytoskeletal proteins that we've made a lot of use of to try to sort of study the function of what happens as parasites divide. One of the proteins that showed up here, you can see the mother and two daughters that are dividing, and this is just a time-lapse series of fluorescence photobleaching studies that allowed us to ask what happens to the mother protein and how those are carried forward. I don't have time to give justice to this work, which isn't really relevant to our purposes here anyway. So I will skip over this and say, just tell you, I'd be happy to talk about it later on, and just end up with some conclusions. Right? Okay, there won't be any. So I'll put this up here and say that. So this is my sort of summary, a lot of things that I think we need. One is large scale data sets and the ability to maintain and access them in ways we talked about last week. Experimentally tractable systems that allow us to study the hypotheses that come out of what we're doing. Methods for trying to establish and test similarities and differences between organelles across species, functions of different secondary endosymbiotic plastids, for example, or of the different manifestations of the alveoli are a real challenge. Computational and statistical methods that allow us to look at phylogenetic and phyletic pattern profiling, in our case, over long periods of time, long after the loss of nucleotide signatures of selection or a particular interest, because we're interested in trying to study how these protein complexes assemble and how they're associated with particular organelles. And I guess I'd submit that we should all be thinking, if we're trying to build a field of evolutionary cell biology, as to what it is that helps people sit up and take notice, that help to define the field. So certainly I've been, the apicoplast story that I told you was really transformative in getting the parasitology community to recognize similarity with other parasites in an area that hasn't devoted much attention to model organisms, and insights that can come from studying things like plastid biology that really changed the field. And I'd like to think that we could come up with some striking examples as well that can turn evolutionary cell biology into a recognized discipline rather than just sort of terms that have all brought us here together for various different reasons.
And this is something that we're going to probably, for those of you who are going to be here for more weeks, this is something we're probably going to come back to over and over again, of what do we mean by evolutionary cell biology, and how do we sort of solidify this field.
So I'll stop there.
Okay, so, thank David.
We can talk over cookies.